Interview with Lynn Tabersack at the WestCon Archives, October 25th, 2016. I'm Brian Stevens, and with me is Kara Swenson, who's a history major here at WestCon.
All right.
And we're creating oral history.
We are, yes.
Sure are.
We sure are. So I was just wondering, what years did you attend WestCon?
Now, I didn't know you were going to ask that. To make a long story short, I believe I started my college education at the University of Connecticut, and I attended their freshman and sophomore years. Went to Europe with my sister. That might have been in 1963, so returned to finish my education here at WestCon, probably 1965.
Okay.
Sure.
So it was an interrupted college education.
What brought you to WestCon?
I lived in Danbury.
And that was, so...
It was affordable. It was very important to me to finish my college education. I wanted to be able to support myself. When I started, I was always interested in becoming a teacher, and it was a teacher's college.
Right. And... tell me a little bit more about your family's history in Danbury.
Well, what's interesting is that my parents bought their first home when I was born in 1943, and they bought the Hamlin property. And when you look at some of the names in my history of Lake Candlewood, you'll see that the Hamlins owned property in what later became Candlewood Lake. Lots of familiar names, the Hawleys, the Moodys, the Lockwoods, and these were all people who I knew as a child growing up. But more important, in their house, which my parents purchased, we discovered a cabinet, and it was behind a wall and opened it, and it was full of stuff. Stuff that really reflected the agrarian, rural kind of nature of society back then. We found an assessment record of all of the people who lived in what was called Great Plain District to build the one-room schoolhouse that is out there on Great Plain Road.
Hmm.
And it's funny, an assessment, people paying $4 or $5
right.
based on the amount of property that they owned. So I think what drove me to this topic was this also this personal relationship with the people who owned our property before we lived there. Mm-hmm. And with one family in particular, the Cubisecs. I went to school with Tommy Cubisec. He was ridiculed when he got on the school bus because his feet were always covered with cow manure and he was accompanied by the smell, but the Cubisecs were one of the families that I knew and that had property that extended back into the basin, and they used for, it was their woodlot property. Hmm. So,
yeah,
I was driven to this subject.
And your family prior to that was a Danbury family, or when they?
Oh no, we're all immigrants.
Okay, all right. So, where are you from?
Well, no,
where is your family?
My father immigrated from England. My mother was the only child born in the United States from her family, which was Irish.
Okay.
And they had, she was born in New Bedford, so old Yankees.
Yeah.
But, what brought your family to Danbury?
The great wave of immigration. My dad started a sign business here. He had studied art in England and was very talented and then started to raise a family and decided he'd better do something where he could earn a living. That's the other thing about a lot of the grantees in this paper is that they all had full-time jobs doing something else, but back on their property, they were mostly agricultural, rural, always doing something extra to supplement their income.
And what was your father's name?
Arthur Houghton.
Arthur Hoot. Now, how did you get Fernandez?
Oh, my goodness. Remember I went to Europe?
Yes.
That's how I got the name Fernandez.
You
married someone from Spain. It was very romantic, very quick, and it didn't work out.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Because I hadn't seen the name Fernandez around in that area, and I was...
No.
Okay.
Yeah. There was a Hooten sign service
okay.
at our address
oh,
for many, many years.
Yeah. I know that I was a little confused because when my uncle had referenced, he's like, the Hootens, and
yes,
it wasn't necessarily...
Yep. Hooten is my maiden name.
Gotcha, okay. Yep.
Can you talk a bit about when you came to WestCon, just briefly about... So you were in WestCon from 64 to basically 68.
Great teachers.
Yeah.
Eric Roman, Truman Warner. I mean, it was a wonderful place to be. Jack Leopold.
Mm-hmm.
Probably all of them are dead now.
Jack Leopold
just
passed away.
Yeah.
And those were some of your favorite professors?
Yep. And you know, there was no West Side campus. Everything
right.
went on here. And mm-hmm. Bill Williams' gym was the gym, not the wonderful facility
yeah.
you have now on the West Side. So it was a small school, intimate, good teachers.
What are your recollections of Truman Warner and his class? It was a senior seminar?
It was a senior seminar where we were required to do a major, what would you call it, using original sources, long paper.
Okay.
Got a whole 3 credits
okay.
for that paper. And what did Truman Warner say about your paper?
I can't recall what he said about it. He was just a fantastic individual. I can remember going to his house.
Yeah.
He lived in Brookfield. I mean, he was that kind of person. He was so excited about students using sources for papers that really connected you to the history that's under our feet.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean...
He must have thought very highly of your paper, though, because he not only retained a copy, but he didn't retain copies of all the papers, but also he copied it.
Ah.
And had used it for at some point, because we have a copy that he made for something. But anyway, so he thought very highly of your paper.
Well, the interesting thing was that right after I graduated, I got an HEW fellowship. So I didn't stay in Danbury. I went to Washington.
What is a HEW fellowship?
Health Education and
okay.
Welfare.
All right.
It was a prospective teacher fellow.
Okay.
It was something Lyndon Johnson thought was a good idea to get smart college graduates to go teach social studies in the inner city. So I went right in 1968 to Spingarn Senior High, Northeast Benning Road in Washington, D.C., and taught U.S. history in a basement classroom where there was no audiovisual, there were no shades to make the room dark to show them anyway. And the kids were penalized if they didn't return their book as sophomores, their social studies book, they couldn't get one as juniors taking American history, so they had to share. And every time, you know, all right, we're going to look at, and they would all group together, and you'd have this blossoming of a social hour because they couldn't have books. So that was quite an experience.
How long did you do that?
Well, as I said, it was a fellowship, so I was in Washington for 2 years. I got a master's degree in urban education, and then came and taught in New York for another 4 or 5 years.
New York State and the...
New York City.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So where in New York City?
Morningside Heights, right under Columbia.
Wow, great.
Yeah.
And you were there for how long?
Just 4 or 5 years.
Oh, okay. And then you found your way back to Danbury.
Found my way back to Danbury. Danbury was never far away.
Okay. Still isn't.
Raised a
it's
family.
Right under our feet.
Raised a family. Looked at the world of work as a 34-year-old and became a licensed plumber in the state of Connecticut.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
I now have a 35-year pin from the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters.
Wow. Wow, I didn't know that.
That's great.
So let's talk a little bit about your paper.
Yeah.
Have you had a chance to look at it again?
I did look at it, and I liked the, I guess we would call it the post-log, where so much of my life post-WestCon has been grown and flourished in what I'm going to call a progressive or liberal tradition, so that if I was writing the paper today, it would have a different angle. I would certainly want to look more closely at a couple of things, the utilities and how they really owned the communities that they were trying to serve, how it wasn't like another Bernie Sanders example of how corporations could dominate the marketplace and kind of work their will. And you wonder, like, the questions, what would happen if First Light, now we don't have a Connecticut Light mm-hmm. Power, what would happen if First Light decided not to fill the basin that was created from the Housatonic River? You know, what kind of impact would that have? And the other,
if they let it run out now,
and it's not clear. It's clear that they legally bought the property that is now covered by the lake, but it is nowhere clear that they're responsible for the water, mm-hmm. the condition of the water, the traffic on the water. I know that I served in the legislature for 8 years, and one of the things people kept asking.
Can I interrupt for 1 second? And you were in the legislature
in Connecticut.
So what were you
representing? Danbury.
Okay, state rep.
Yeah.
Okay.
That people wanted, just like you have in theaters or in any kind of community room, they wanted a number put up there. Mm-hmm. All right, we can only have 533 boats on the lake on any given day because more than that would create a dangerous situation, would create a nuisance. So that we find that we've created a body of water that actually the communities end up paying for in terms of traffic on it, problems with milfoil, eutrophication, all of these issues which the corporation that eventually benefited from making hydroelectric power has left to us. You know, why is it us? Why is it the taxpayers and not the corporate entities?
You touch on that a little bit in your paper.
A little bit, but yeah. Not very much. And the other thing was how the ordinary property owners in the basin that sold their lots, and you look at that list and you see all the different prices and the different sizes of the parcels, how they were kind of, they were bamboozled. They didn't understand the value that would accrue once the basin was flooded and there was a natural wonder like this. So they were kind of ripped off in this process. And they're dead and gone now. I mean, I can't talk to Tommy Kubicek's father. You know, he's not here anymore. And I think a lot of the people who had some foresight, and you see their names over and over again, the Branson, the Pickett, actually Keating, the guy who did all the legal work, ended up having a real estate business that marketed properties around the lake.
Can we talk about the acquisition of the land a little bit and see what you remember about it? So one of the things that Kara and I did is we
went back.
The first thing we did is like we're going to go to the Danbury City Hall and look at what Landmarkers. You had transcribed in your paper, but they were having to be closed that day. So we went to New Fairfield and saw basically the same pattern. And I wonder if you recall, like, the thing that sticks out to us in looking at these things are you have a transaction between C.L. Campbell and the landowner.
Yes.
Right, and the transfer doesn't happen immediately. It happens most of the time after water is going into the lake.
Yes.
And most times that the actions of C.L. Campbell are characterized as an agent of CLNP.
I think I called him a straw man.
Okay, or a straw. You call him a straw man. I think I've seen other people write about him as an agent for CLMP. However, none of the documents in New Fairfield or Danbury reflect his role as an agent for CLMP. It's simply
an individual purchasing the property.
Right. And did that strike you as curious at the time?
You know, I can't recall whether it struck me as curious, but what did strike me as curious was that all of the parcels were transferred to CLMP in a very narrow time frame.
Yeah, and when we were looking at it, you know, all these years later, in 67 you were only, you know, 40 years afterwards. Now we're a full 40 years after your paper. So it looks a bit odd. And what I expected that Kara and I would come across would be some notation on the grantor-grantee list of Campbell's relationship to CLMP.
And there would be.
There is none. Yeah. And straw man or not, if you wrote about it, the straw man policy. I want to ask you about that a little bit too. But as a straw man, he would have been an agent operating for the corporation.
Yeah.
Been no need for a transfer
later.
Yeah.
A straw man has no right to eminent domain.
Right.
Right, yeah.
So that's the big hole there.
Yeah.
And I don't think I could ever prove or whether anybody could ever prove that all of the grantees were informed that this individual was representing an entity, a corporation, that had the power of eminent domain.
Right.
But I'm sure they were told, we want to offer to buy your property because we have a hydroelectric project. We're going to flood this basin, which is like a natural basin, really, mm-hmm. in many cases, draining the whole watershed between New York State's border into our area. I'm sure that when he was making these offers to the grantees that he was indicating that he had the power of eminent domain, or else why would they give up their property?
And you highlight that in one section of your paper too. Yeah.
Then we came across J. Henry Rohrbach, and all the questions were answered. He had tremendous power.
He did, and it's interesting that they had, if you look all the way back to, what was it, 1917, when they were really arguing about, can we create a basin that creates enough hydroelectric, enough watts or for it to be profitable for us, not that we want to benefit the entire universe, because as I said in the paper, people were heating with wood and using kerosene for lighting, and it was a bet on the future. But all of New England was like this giant reservoir of falling rivers mm-hmm. going to Long Island Sound that you could use to create sawmills and grist mills and all kinds of commercial entities. But they did get a wonderful 97-foot drop by creating this basin, because at Stevenson, I think it's only 70 feet.
Oh, really? Because it looks like, when you go over the Stevenson Dam, it's like...
It looks like, whoa!
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it does look like that.
And then the irony is, this all goes on from 1917 to when they actually approve it and then start acquiring the properties and building the lake in this 2-year period, is that now it's like the amount of kilowatts produced is inconsequential for the needs of our state for power.
Right, and the amount of infrastructure that they have to maintain.
No, as I said, I think I said in the paper, you'd have to flood the entire state of Connecticut.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have to all be wearing snorkels.
That's nice.
what surprised me was that I suggested that nuclear power was like the only option left for a state like Connecticut. I don't know if I would say that now, but hydroelectric is very green, so,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
It's more appealing.
And
so it doesn't impact climate change.
So one of the, you know, key parts, and we mentioned this earlier about your paper, was your bibliography. And particularly the items in the bibliography that are not unpublished materials, interviews. You cite some photographs from the Sanford family, I think, things like that. So how did you come across those? Actually, before you answer that.
I knew all those families.
Did you? Okay.
Yes.
And they volunteered that material for it?
The Sanfords, I was in Mrs. Sanford's Girl Scout troop as a kid.
Okay.
I mean, I haven't moved, and, you know, I did go to Washington, I did go to New York and teach, but I really have been around for Danbury for like 73 years. All of those names are very familiar to me. The Metelskis, I mean, I knew where their houses were. It's changed a lot, but those were all
and
local folks.
Your connection with, I can't remember the name of the fellow from CLMP.
Lewis?
Yeah.
Was it? Yeah.
Yep.
He's gone.
No. But how did you...
But I don't know whether I taped any of those interviews, you know, or whether I did it from notes. I don't think we necessarily had great technology.
Yeah, it would have been rare for you to have a cassette in 67.
Yeah, there would have been big...
Reel-to-reel.
It's because it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And as I said, I got scooped right up to do something very exciting.
Right. And so
with the Great Society, and I went off and did that.
And CLMP, you mentioned, were somewhat cooperative with you. They provided maps.
And I believe that they still have documents that people can research. When I looked back at this paper, and I only did it last night, I said, this story isn't quite finished.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it ought to be thorough. It ought to include all of the five towns surrounding Candlewood Lake. It ought to have more information about the Indians who hunted and trapped in the basin, and they might have even been part of the New York State Indian.
Okay.
One of the other things I just want to touch on is that Danbury, the Danbury end of the lake, was really developed in a very roughshod manner with no zoning forethought or oversight. And I can remember those first communities like Tagging Point and Aqua Vista, how the lot size was small, the houses weren't winterized.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a quick buck. And the other communities seemed to have realized the value that the lake would add to properties along the lakefront. And I taught swimming in Aqua Vista as a high school student. There were mariner scouts, and they were specifically related to water-related activities. And we would swim across Lake Candlewood, and we learned to sail on Lake Candlewood. It was all connected with that. So it was the lake, and we're going to say, let's see, if I was born in 43, so we're going to say from 1950 to 1960, it was just a gorgeous natural resource that people in our community really enjoyed and benefited from. Danbury, and I can just remember the foundations, they would be on like cinder blocks, you'd have four cinder blocks on each corner. The houses were ticky-tacky.
Yeah.
And now I think you can find properties in the surrounding towns that are, you know, that sell for millions of dollars.
Right.
So, and that was the Bronson Pickett Keating gang that kind of came in and saw an opportunity for that kind of development. And the city of Danbury was very slow in putting appropriate zoning in those areas.
You cite Bronson and I can't remember.
And Keating.
Yeah, but you cite materials related to Bronson and Pickett from that you got from some person that you knew. Were Bronson and Pickett still alive when you were a kid?
I don't know. I imagine so. They seemed to be prominent community members from their addresses.
Right. But do you recall, you know, they were doing a lot of their transactions in the 40s and 50s. Was there any, you know, perception of them as being being very astute businessmen who were the ones that capitalized on the lake?
Yeah. Yes, that they were astute. And there's a point in every community when they say, we want to grow. Growth is good. Let's grow. This is great. You know, more people buying things, buying refrigerators, buying brooms, buying dustpans. This is wonderful, wonderful. It's recognized as a good thing.
You wrote about Pickett and Bronson also being on North Street, which you had mentioned that was kind of the
CLMP.
Right, that was kind of the office, and it was just interesting how did they first get wind of, like, being bought up.
And the things in my paper that I love to tell you how I got it or found it was the fact that there was only one bathroom and they had to walk through this man's bedroom to get to it. I mean, I have no idea where that came from. Except it would have come
probably
from
one of the interviews that you did.
Yeah.
So just a couple questions about, so you've continued to have this relationship with Candlewood Lake. Do you visit it, or do you live near it still?
It's in poor condition now. I live in the same house.
Okay.
I live on the Hamlin property.
All right.
They're on one of those maps.
Okay.
But the condition at the town park is awful. Mm-hmm. It's the geese. So that if I took my grandchildren there, we have to walk around geese poop. Mm-hmm. They tried putting up fake black dogs maybe 5 or 6 years ago. That hasn't worked. The milfoil infestation is awful.
Do you stay involved with the lake at all, like in terms of advocacy? Or?
No, I did in the legislature. I actually established a grant program for lakes that were eutrophying. So eutrophication.
Yeah.
So that there was this grant program, but it never was funded adequately. So I believe the only lake that applied for funding was Manamasco in Ridgefield, which is a very small, very eutrophic lake that is completely choked by Eurasian milfoil. But that then begs the question of what we have is right now the New Fairfield Board of Selectmen withholding their payment to the Candlewood Lake Authority because they disagree with something that the Lake Authority has decided will benefit Candlewood Lake. So you have thrown this problem of quality, water quality, and traffic on the lake. You've thrown it to five communities that need to cooperate and maintain some semblance of order and preserve the quality of the water in Lake Candlewood, and that is not going to work. That's where we have to go back and say, okay, First Light, you have a big responsibility here, and yet then the towns will turn around and fight First Light on very important conditions that can help save the lake, like you cannot have a golf course green grass front on your property. You have to have natural vegetation above, not reaching down to the water, that stops the runoff of phosphorus and other fertilizers and things into the lake. And the towns won't give up that zoning authority.
It's interesting, in your paper, you actually foreshadow, at the end, you talk about the floating island. And you sort of foreshadow. You don't talk a lot about it, but it's in your appendix. But it is almost a symbolism of like this problem.
Whose problem is it?
and at the time, do you recall whether in your research, if you came across any of discussion of these, like they wouldn't have called them environmental concerns, but because I've read other articles about stands of logs that would float to the surface and scare people because the contractors hadn't hauled them out; they had chained them to the bottom.
Wow!
But you don't recall any discussion of environmental issues and the.
There wasn't an environmental sense.
Yeah.
At that point in history, when the lake was created, you didn't have organizations that were actively concerned with environmental issues.
I didn't care. Dirty water generates electricity
just
like
as
clean.
Well as clean water. Yeah,
and that probably should give the communities pause around, because the people who created the lake have that point of view that it doesn't matter. Still turns a turbine if it's
dirty or clean, and it's true.
But the milfoil might slow it down.
It would.
Edwin Dayhill. Does that name ring a bell?
It doesn't. Who is that?
He was a faculty member of WESCON in 1966 in the Social Sciences Department, and he wrote his dissertation on J. Henry Rohrbach.
Wow.
And Dayhill. A fluke that he had taught here. He wrote his dissertation for Columbia. He happened to be the owner of Rohrbach's papers.
Wow.
But because he had been at WESCON, I was wondering if there was some cross-pollination between...
There wasn't. I wonder what ever happened. Did he keep his papers? Have they...
Well, here's the other thing that we've discovered. Dayhill kept his papers until sometime maybe in the 70s, 80s. He gave his papers to a man named Jack Craig from Westchester County. Jack Craig was the son of J. Henry Rohrbach.
Wow.
And Jack Craig gave Rohrbach's papers to the State Library. And Rohrbach's papers are at the State Library. But I was wondering if you recall ever.
No, that would have been wonderful.
Thinking about Rohrbach's papers, or
that would have been wonderful to know.
Just as an aside,
Truman should have told me.
Well, Truman wouldn't have known.
He wouldn't. Huh?
He may have known about Dayhill, but see, Dayhill didn't write his dissertation until 1971.
Okay.
Yeah. But somehow we don't know. He's actually still alive. He's 97. So, looking up when Rohrbach passed away, the newspaper article talked about Rohrbach left, $3.8 million to his wife and son, and $50,000 to Mary Collins. And in my mind, that seemed and in dollars, it's basically $1 million in 1937, which. Is a lot for your secretary.
Yeah.
On from there. But it's sort of interesting that the life of Henry Rohrbach, who was this very powerful person who...
he called the shots.
And then he offed himself in his front yard.
Yeah.
It's a very odd sort of end to... And then, to find this other tidbit about him... probably added to his stress a little bit.
Yeah.
But anyway. But thank you so much for coming in and
You're
talking
welcome.
To us.